You're listening to the Binge Media Podcast Network on bingemedia.net. And now, the Binge Aftertaste.
The following is my explanation. Well, more of an account of what happened. I'd been on my own for a while and getting kind of lonely and bored. Nothing to do all day. And that's when I started shadowing.
Shadowing,
following. I started to follow people.
Who?
Anyone, first. That was the whole point. Somebody at random. Somebody who didn't know who I was.
And then?
And then nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. I just see where they went, what they did. Go home afterwards.
Why'd you do it?
See where they went. Anyone, how can I explain? You ever, been to a football match, just let your eyes, go over, drift across a crowd of people. And they slowly stop and fix on one person, and all of a sudden that person isn't part of the crowd anymore. They become an individual. Just like that. Just became irresistible.
Welcome to this review of Following, part of the Binge Movie Aftertaste Christopher Nolan Retrospective.
Nothing here of any value.
Interesting that concerned.
I don't do it for the money.
Why do you do?
For the adrenaline. And because, like you, I'm interested in people.
Join Garrett, Matt, and Jack as they go through the praised British filmmaker's entire resume, one movie at a time, all leading up to a review of his highly anticipated latest film, Tenet.
People wouldn't be anywhere near 40 with a futon.
Is Nolan's fandom an act of overpraise?
Hey, you can tell a lot about people from their stuff.
Does his deconstruction of metaphysical themes in his work constitute a positive trait?
They're college educated, probably graduated when they're 21 or 22, moved in together in the last year.
Will Matt still be standing when this retrospective is over?
What the hell did you do that for?
It's like a diary. They hide it. But actually, they want someone to see it. That's what I do.
Find out the answers to these questions and many more, all coming up, courtesy of Binge Media.
You take it away. You show them what they had.
Following, released September 12th, 1998. Budget on this was $6,000. Box office, $495,000. And this was directed, as every movie in this retrospective is, by the one and only Chris Nolan. Christopher Nolan, if you will. All right. Christopher Nolan retrospective. Lot to get into with this gentleman. We all have thoughts on it and why I finally decided to do it. Both gentlemen on this podcast have differing views on this. I'm kind of in the middle, which means I'll probably be the referee for this retrospective. Before I go to Matt, who's my normal co-host, I want to go to the gentleman who pushed for this retrospective, the one and only Jack Falvey. How's it going, Jack?
Yo, yo, yo.
What's up? Chris Nolan, you have been pushing for this, I swear to God, since Tenet was announced 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But I need to know, why was it so important for you to get into the oeuvre of one and only Christopher Nolan?
This is a little known fact around here. Maybe I kid, of course. But I really like Nolan. And in my entire time at Binge Media, he's made quite a few movies. A lot of them have been ones that I've really loved. And I just think that he's one of the more interesting filmmakers these days. I think he does a good job of straddling the line of big budget blockbuster film and doing enough inside of them that is, for himself. And I really enjoy the guy's work. And I think with a movie like Tenet coming out, I think it's worth kind of reviewing what he's done at this point and talking it out. So,
all right. So Jack has put himself out there as the fan. Mr. Matthew Goudreau, sir, you are on this retrospective. You were hesitant to do this retrospective. You don't seem to be a big fan of the man. Where are you coming from when it comes to Christopher Nolan?
Well, much like one of his movies about dueling magicians, appearances can be deceiving, my friend. Let me begin by saying that I like Christopher Nolan as a filmmaker, for the most part.
Jeez, Garrett, let him talk. What the hell?
Yeah, I know. Like, what the fuck? That was... Anyway, so it's funny how Christopher Nolan and my friendship with Garrett Collins sort of coincide. There's much more of a connection to this than you would think, in that probably about, 7 years ago at this point, maybe a little bit longer, I used to be in a film group on Facebook. It was like a film discussion group, and it seemed like every other discussion was about Christopher Nolan. Garrett's laughing because I'm not fucking kidding. And these would be 300 comment threads, and I always stayed away because it seemed very cutthroat, for lack of a better word. And whenever this guy Garrett Collins would chime in, I would disagree with his take, and we would get into arguments back and forth. Now, little did I know, this motherfucker would not only become a close friend of mine, he would also be a co-worker of mine in various capacities. So for everyone who thinks that Garrett and I don't argue enough, I think this retrospective in particular is going to put that argument to rest, because I think there's going to be a lot of disagreements among the three of us. I will say, independent of that discussion, I think Nolan, I admire him because he's sort of like what Jack said. It's very rare nowadays that a director's name that's not of the old guard, you know, your Scorsese's, your Tarantino's, your Spielberg's, can put out a movie on just their name and their cachet, and both mainstream and film geek audiences will gravitate towards it. No pun intended, because he has movies with zero gravity, but it's one of those things to where he's got a very dedicated fan base. I've heard the term Nolanites. I think that's an accurate comparison, where you cannot say a single bad thing about him without someone trying to stick their foot up your ass. And I think that mentality, I understand dedicated fandom, but with like a lot of things that have happened today, funny I'm saying this on the eve of a Zack Snyder cut being released for Justice League, but certain directors have a cult-like mentality around them, to where it's kind of frustrating to express your opinion as someone who doesn't think they're this all-powerful gift to cinema. So that's my five-minute dissertation, but that's appropriate considering how Christopher Nolan loves expository dialogue, so it kind of fits perfectly.
It's funny you mentioned that fan base, because I find a lot of that goes with Stanley Kubrick as well. Somebody who, if you say one bad thing about it, from all directions, you're going to get people who dislike what you say. You know, I'm right in the middle of you, gentlemen. There are times, like when the film we're going to talk about next week, Memento, came out, I saw it at the movies, and I'll just spoil this right now, fell in love with it, but as time has gone on, there have been movies that have come out of his that I adore, and there have been movies of his that I can't stand. And so I am right in the middle. I went through a real period where I couldn't stand the man. And that film group, I coined the term, you said Nolanites, I said Nolan nerds. Nothing this guy did went by these people without them defending it. And no matter what you could say, and just to preface this, Jack and I covered his Batman films probably about 5 years ago at this point. Yeah. 4 years ago, getting ready for Justice League. So if you guys want to check out our thoughts on that, they are in the archives of Binge Media. There were just times when I just couldn't stand the man. So I am right in the middle of you, gentlemen. I feel like he's one of those filmmakers who is very celebrated. And hell, if you mentioned the Snyder Cut, I mean, who else do we have to look up to at this point? Zack Snyder? You know, like of our modern film landscape, he's the one who people tend to gravitate towards. And in some ways, I respect the hell out of him. In some ways, I kind of don't. So this will be interesting to go through his oeuvre, because a lot of these I haven't seen in quite a while.
Just before we go further on that, I will say, Matt, I agree with you. There is definitely a cult-like following with Nolan's films. You see it on Reddit a lot. It's very... I totally agree with you. It's very annoying. You're right. People cannot objectively look at his stuff. And, you know, like, it's okay to point out flaws. Nothing's ever going to be perfect, you know? Like, I always bring it up, but, like, yeah, okay. Sonny absolutely pulls his punches when he's beating the shit out of Carlo in The Godfather. Like, you see it, you know? But, like, who fucking cares? Like, the rest, everything else is great, you know? And it's the same, too. It is with Kubrick as well, and I happen to like both of them. But yeah, this should be interesting.
It's funny that you mentioned The Godfather, because there is no such thing as a perfect movie, because fiction by its very nature is fundamentally flawed. So no matter how meticulous or careful you are as a director, there's just going to be a natural screw up along the way. It could be something major like a plot hole, or it could be something minor as, you know, the lighting was wrong in a particular scene. But I agree, you know, David Cronenberg's my favorite director, but I certainly can put some of his work to task. And I'm disappointed that you guys have already covered the Batman films, because that was my introduction to Nolan as a filmmaker. I saw Batman Begins when I was 11 or 12 when that came out. Didn't like it because of just what I liked about the character at the time, but I've gone back to it, and Nolan's put his stamp on the genre.
So Chris Nolan, a lot like Tarantino, he did not go to film school, but he does have an English literature degree, which if you watch his films, all of that comes out. So this first movie we're going to discuss today, Following, this was a movie I had no idea about until I think around the time Interstellar was coming out. I did a whole look at his films, my own mini retrospective, shall we say. And that was a film I was not aware of. Jack, were you aware of this? Even like going back to when you first discovered Nolan?
Yeah, actually, I got this on DVD at the time. I'm trying to think of when I might have. I mean, I definitely found out about Nolan through Memento. I probably, Batman Begins was the first Nolan movie I saw in a theater. And I feel like very soon after that, I got Following. In fact, I think this was at the end of my Columbia House days. But I'm pretty sure I bought American Psycho and Following at the same time, because after seeing Batman Begins, I wanted to see, they had said that Bale was chosen in large part because of American Psycho's performance. And then I also, because I was attacking films from the perspective of directors, I wanted to have Nolan's first movie as well. So I know I got it around the same time as American Psycho, and I probably watched them both in close proximity.
So much like Pulp Fiction, when we covered Quentin Tarantino last year, Batman Begins was your gateway to you discovering the earlier projects of his.
For sure, yeah.
Matt, have you seen this before we started this retrospective?
I had seen it, but my introduction was through a trivia, like, you know, one of those bar trivia nights where they said, what's Christopher Nolan's first film? And I said Memento, just forgetting about this movie completely. And that kind of inspired me to go, you know what, I should give this another look. This was my one blind spot among Nolan's filmography. Just really went to go back and watch it, because I looked at the runtime, to be perfectly honest. I was like, does this even qualify as a feature film? Because,
yeah,
you know, the Oscars, you have to reach a certain runtime. And I'm like, is this just like a technical exercise or a demo reel? So I never went out of my way to watch this until Interstellar was coming out. And I went through all of his movies, because to be honest, when I was 12 or 13 or walking out of Batman Begins and I wasn't so hot on it at the time, I was like, you know what? I really don't feel like watching this guy's other work.
Something curious when I looked into this, because I bought the Criterion DVD for this review.
Nice.
And looking at that, he does have a commentary on there. And this thing was made for $6,000. I've been on quite a few independent films. All of them were at least five times that. Now, the fact that he got this made for $6,000 astounds me.
So... yeah, I definitely want to talk about this a little bit. I wanted to try and catch some, not quite bonus features, but I looked online to find interviews with Nolan about Following, because after watching this again, I realized I had never actually heard him talk about this movie at all. And there's a really great 20-minute interview that Vice did.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where he talks about the little things that he did, he built into the movie to sort of trick the audience into dealing with, say, subpar audio. He started the movie with a voiceover that then transitioned into scenes of just naturally recorded audio. And what that did was, in the minds of the audience, they were more willing to accept it because the framing device of the interview acted as their sort of ground zero, and then the audience would be willing to go with you after that and then come back to it. But there were a lot of little things about that interview that I thought were really interesting from the perspective of somebody just trying to make a movie and save money wherever they could. Very interesting. Very interesting.
Caught that interview as well, and he says a lot of things in that. You know, in watching this, I was thinking, like, why the fuck would you do this in black and white? This is your first, I guess you could say, feature. I guess it could qualify as a feature. Sure. 70 minutes. Why would you do it in black and white? And he had a very interesting answer. He said the reason why he did it in black and white was simple fact, because of lighting. He could film somebody at a window, and that light from the window would prevent him from having to put lights on his actors as they were performing. And I agree, Jack. If you're looking to get into film, it is a really good crash course in how to do just, I guess you could just say, guerrilla filmmaking. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I even like the fact that he name-dropped Clerks and El Mariachi, because
yes,
it really reminded me of some of the stuff in, was it Rebel Without a Camera? Rebel Without a Crew? The Robert Rodriguez book? It was just cool to hear that at one point Nolan was also sort of inspired by that stuff and took some of those techniques to heart in his own way. You see what he makes now. It's easy to forget that he started as a, you know, an independent British filmmaker just trying to get films made. I thought that was pretty cool.
I haven't seen that documentary or that interview, I should say, but I read a lot of sort of the production history through like diaries and stuff. And they mentioned how one of the other reasons that it's black and white was that you don't have to worry about color rendering to match your light kits and that kind of stuff. They couldn't get public permits to shoot outside on the street locations. So, you know, you kind of had to do it when no one was around. The most interesting one to me was that he only permitted the actors to do two takes, and they had to be precise going in because they couldn't afford to do reshoots or any extensive editing to get around
it. Yeah, pretty wild.
Yeah. I also want to say, before we get into the plot, we're going to go through this movie as it happens on screen and where there are discrepancies in the plot and time, because this is, like a lot of his work, this is nonlinear. And I didn't realize that it started this far back, that he started going nonlinear with the storytelling with Following. And I mean, it was happening around that time. I mean, Jack, you and I covered Tarantino last year, Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels. These movies were coming out and they were all nonlinear. So it wasn't like it was a precedent or anything, but it's just funny how you go this far back in his filmography and he was already doing that kind of storytelling.
It's a huge theme in his work. I mean, obviously we'll talk about it in pretty much every one of his movies, but time is a massive through line in all of his films. Yes.
We start off, we see some white gloves put together a box, and right away I'm going to say, Nolan starts off with this David Julian score. David Julian's his composer, and he'll have him through the first few films of his career, and David Julian's even done stuff like Cabin in the Woods. Like, he's a working composer. Mm-hmm. So right away I'm captivated by the intense uptick of the music, and there are some great melodies later on, but Nolan's penchant for making operatic dramas put to music starts pretty early here.
Yeah. I maybe my favorite thing about this movie is the score. I didn't remember the music at all. The whole like nonlinear time thing, the way that surprised you, to me, the music surprised me more than anything, because I thought that his marriage of intensity and like bombastic score was really when Hans Zimmer showed up. I had totally forgotten about this score, but I really liked the whole score of this film.
Yeah, me too. I was surprised how much I liked it, because, you know, I'm putting intros together for all these shows, so I got to go through each and every bit of music that he has out there, and I was shocked at how much of this was actually really good. We then meet who was labeled in the credits as the young man, but he calls himself Bill in this, so that's what I'm going to refer to him as I go through this podcast. We hear Bill talking to who we think is a psychologist, and we hear that he is a struggling writer, so in order to come up with some ideas, he has taken up a habit of following people from place to place, getting an idea of where they are going and what kind of people they are, while swearing that it's nothing sexual. You know, I have to say, as somebody who lived and worked in Hollywood for a few years, I understand this artist mentality. This is an artist mentality. I've caught myself in coffee shops and restaurants just listening in on conversations, including conversations and scripts and such, writing them down. How do we feel right off the bat, boys, about Bill and his habit of following people?
It's interesting. It does feel like, I know he's not in film school, but it does feel a little bit like film student, how I need to create a character that does something in order to get them to do something else kind of thing. It feels a little artificial, but I don't hate it. It's very much a means to an end kind of thing, though.
I sort of echo Jack's comment in that the genesis of this character stems from the creative process as a filmmaker and as a writer. So on one hand, I find it a little bit pretentious, but in the same way that this film establishes Nolan's approach to time as both thematic and structural elements of his movies, another thing that this movie establishes that he'll do a lot is that most of his characters tend to have, his main characters, some kind of ethical code or structure to their life, because he talks about how, I don't follow women into long alleys, and, you know, you got to keep a certain distance. So that's another thing that he employs in a lot of his movies. That's oftentimes how he defines his characters, is from the way they live their life, as opposed to the letting their emotions guide them. Because one thing I say about Nolan all the time is that he's a very cold filmmaker for the most part. He's very cerebral, and that extends to this film, because this is a character not driven by pathos. It's one who's driven by ethics.
That's an interesting take, actually. Yeah.
Jack, you mentioned the voiceover. The reason why he has so much voiceover here in the beginning is because Nolan knew that he had a pretty shitty sound mix in this, and he wanted to try to set his characters and story up as good as possible. And I've been on record on this show, I'm normally not a fan of voiceover, but I think it was a wise choice to use it here. It sets us up pretty well. I think.
I think it's a decent framing device. And the way that he put this story together, I think it works in its favor later on, too. It's definitely, you know, in terms of debut feature, I don't know. You could tell that he put a lot of thought into how to construct this. That's sort of one of the things that I admire him most for, is him being like a real tactician as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
So I kind of appreciated that aspect of it by the end. It's a little, yeah. It's like, you know, that thing in adaptation. It's like, God help you if you ever use fucking voiceover, right? But, but I mean, there are times when it works, you know, and it kind of works here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, to quote Bane, it's a necessary evil because it's a way in a movie where you only have 69 minutes. It's a way to get exposition out of the way.
Yeah.
Part of the joke of the film's title is how much the film jumps, you know, which I counted four separate time frames. Is what I counted when watching this. And if you're not paying attention, you're going to have a hard time following this thing. I just found that joke with the film's title just kind of funny.
Mm.
Also, Nolan only had, again, $6,000, and obviously not much of that was spent in the sound mix. So some of the accents and mounds of things happening made the characters sometimes hard to understand. So at one point, I actually did put my subtitles on. The accents kind of got to me a little bit in this film, where it was hard to decipher what they were saying. So.
Yes. Well, speaking of his contemporaries, it reminds me a lot of Guy Ritchie's early films, where the accents are very difficult to hear through.
So we learned that Bill had to make up rules in order to keep things under control. Don't follow one person for too long. Don't follow girls down dark alleys. And it is at this point where I want to pose a question to you guys. There are inner cuts of Bill at his typewriter, and beside him is a picture of Marilyn Monroe. And our very next shot is of Bill holding pictures of a girl with brown hair, but when she walks from her apartment, she is wearing pretty much the exact same haircut and color as Marilyn Monroe. Did you guys at any point, when you first watched this, did you at any point, given that this is a struggling writer who we'll see gets involved in what we find out is a very intricate plot, did we think that the characters Bill interacts with were figments of his imagination? Because that went through my mind a few times the first time I watched this.
Not really. No, I think this one is fairly straightforward. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'd go with that one necessarily.
I agree and disagree, but for different reasons. The picture I associate was the one of The Shining, because there's a lot of theories that Jack Torrance is typing, like what you're seeing in the film, more so than the book, is like the machinations of a story that he's writing. So like, I thought that was a neat little homage to Kubrick, but I sort of disagree just because Nolan, this is sort of reinforced by me seeing a lot of his other films, is that he doesn't, for the most part, he's not a very ambiguous filmmaker. He tends to be very literal. And I think sometimes that's a strength, sometimes that's a weakness. So here in my mind, I never thought of it being ambiguous. I thought everything was pretty straightforward outside of just the way he's structuring the story.
We then cut to Bill laying down, coughing a white glove out of his mouth, and he's then at his typewriter with a big shiner on his eye. And this is my first what the fuck moment of this film for me, where I was like, okay, what, how did he get this black eye? You know, like, again, I didn't realize this was going to be a time jumping thing.
Mm-hmm.
I will say Nolan does a very nice job with the time jumps. I never feel lost. Characters walk downstairs and open doors to a whole new time period. And Bill's hair is also a good sign of where we are at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Still, Jack, I want to pose this question to you. Do you think the time jump thing in this film, I'm not talking about later on in his career, but in this film, do you think it's too gimmicky for this film?
I think it's the thing that kept me interested in it, honestly. So I've kind of figured this out about myself, obviously, with like how I work and all that stuff, but I'm very left-brained, right? Like I like thinking about things from a logical perspective. I value the process of going through something more than maybe expertly executing every step of the list. You know, there's something about the way that I think that's satisfying for me. And I think that caters to what I like about Kubrick and Nolan as much as I do, in that I love the precision and the craft of what Nolan does. You know, I was immediately reminded of Heart Eight, the first Paul Thomas Anderson movie, when I was watching this.
Yeah.
Not so much thematically, but more that movie to me, it just doesn't gel for me. Like, I think Philip Baker Hall is fine. Some of the other performances are fine. But that movie doesn't really coalesce. It feels like a bunch of concepts that, like, a filmmaker starting out with. I kind of feel the same way about Bottle Rocket.
Mm.
They're decent starts, but they're not really made, to me, by the same filmmaker that then goes on to make, you know, Boogie Nights or
Rushmore, you know, like it's just it seems like the style is far more perfected with the second film, which makes sense. I feel the same way about Following in a certain regard with Nolan's stuff, but I think that Nolan has a more clearly defined idea of what he likes about making film and like what he wants to get across with filmmaking at first. And I think that to me justifies the time jump stuff. That being said, I could probably see the other side of the argument in thinking that it might be too gimmicky, but I think it was the main thing that kept me engaged with the story. So make it that what you will.
God, this is going to be like a psychoanalysis between Jack and I, because I'm a right brain person through and through. And, you know, I like, you know, sort of the creative process through emotion. And like I said, this is a tough movie to do that with because it's very, everyone's very understated. But I agree with Jack as far as this being more of a template for Nolan's work as opposed to later on. But I have another film comparison. Speaking of Kubrick, I compare it to Killer's Kiss.
Yeah, for sure.
Because obviously they're both sort of, they're crime films at their core about someone getting involved with a woman and her violent employer. Mm-hmm. But also they're films that you could see traces of the person's style and their sort of low-key structure, but it's not quite a finished product. It's just, I think Nolan and Kubrick are very similar for a multitude of reasons, but not just because of, I tend to think of those two films in tandem.
Yeah, there's an option on the DVD I have where, a lot like Memento, you can watch it in its chronological order. And, you know, I did watch that for this podcast. I did put that on. And I think a lot of the strength of this movie lies in its reveals as we find out certain things. Like, why the fuck is this guy laying on the ground with a fucking glove in his mouth? Well, when we find out why, that's part of the wow moments. So I think it does tend to get gimmicky, but for this movie, it does kind of work for me because I like the reveals. I like the way he formats them. So Bill reveals in his voiceover that his most important rule is to not continue following somebody once he learned where they worked and lived, but that's the rule he ironically breaks first. Bill heads into a coffee shop, and it is here where we meet Cobb, who asks why he's following him. I like this scene quite a bit, as it also does a nice job of setting up what the relationship between these two guys is going to be like. I also want to say that normally when you come across a famous director's first work, it's riddled with friends of that director, and the acting in them isn't always great. I mean, you guys have obviously seen El Mariachi, right?
Of course.
I respect Rodriguez a lot for getting that thing made, but the acting in it is pretty horrendous. Yeah. Here, these guys give a pretty good performance. Bill, especially with this look, the coat, the longest hair, almost like a James McAvoy vibe to me. How do you guys feel about the acting in this film?
I think it's solid. I don't think it's groundbreaking. I don't think it's incredible.
No.
But I think that both of the leads, they're pretty good. I don't really have much of an issue with either of them. In fact, now that you're making me think about it, I don't really have a problem with any of the acting in this movie. There isn't much to it. And again, I'm going to keep going back to this, but it's cold, clinical, calculated. Yes, I would describe Nolan like that. And I'd also say that those are the things I like about his filmmaking. And I think that he uses these actors the way that he wants to. And it's pretty efficient and it works, but it's not emotionally heavy or weighty, I guess is what I'm trying to say there. But yeah, it's fine.
I think it does a good job of building up tension. And I think Nolan does a good job of escalation without going into a pontification about philosophy, which I think he sometimes gets a little full of himself at points. But here, I think, again, because he's so restricted, everything has to move within a respectable time frame. Like there can't be any dead air whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. I like how when Cobb approaches Bill, like he's taken aback and he knows that he's been caught. But how does Cobb respond? By buying him a cup of coffee. You know, yeah. He's wanting to get inside his head. So Cobb tells Bill his name and shows him what's in his bag, which is a huge set of CDs he was going to sell. Remember when you could do that, kids, when you could sell CDs for profit? This makes Bill curious as they head to an apartment. And this is where Cobb puts the gloves on and they use the key to get in. They grab a bag, gaze through the apartment, and Cobb's telling Bill that you can tell a lot about someone by going through their stuff. It is also here where Cobb tells Bill about the box that everyone has and that he does this to cause people to re-examine their lives by interrupting them, which includes drinking their wine and putting panties in the guy's pants so the girl finds them when he comes home, which obviously they do when there's Cobb and Bill are still there. A couple things here. One, why wouldn't the owners of the apartment call the police when they walk in? And two, why is Bill still fascinated by Cobb? Wouldn't something like this cause someone to kind of walk away?
Yeah, I mean, this is the whole thing, right? You kind of, suspension of disbelief has to be elevated in order to go with this premise. I'm thinking the same thing. Like, yeah, I just call the cops, regardless of who you're with. I don't know. It just seems like the right thing to do. yeah. It's kind of strange that nobody's doing it. But I'm not happy about it when it happens. But, you know, I'm also, I don't know, I'm giving it a little leeway.
It's the make or break point. It's sort of the point in this movie where you're either with it or you're not. And unfortunately, I'm kind of with the proposition that Garrett brought up. I think there is a point where this character, the nameless character, he gets into over his head. And he's pretty unsympathetic throughout most of the movie, to be perfectly honest. And it's difficult for me to sympathize with his setup later on, because he does also come across as kind of aloof and, I don't want to say stupid, but I think there is such a thing as you would know. If you're this smart about, you know, your own sort of ethics with following people, why are you sort of compromising those with burglarizing and those other kind of things?
Right.
Especially because it's not sexual. He's not really doing it for monetary profit or for a writing approach. So it doesn't quite gel for me.
This brings up an issue I have with a few of Nolan's movies. You know, it's one of the only issues I have with The Dark Knight. And I cannot believe it started as early as this movie. We're eventually going to find out that this is a huge plan on the part of Cobb to get away. This plan has to be perfectly executed. Not one thing can go wrong with this plan. And I don't know, man, just to find somebody to cut their hair and to get themselves involved in this and then have him go to the police and then the police find all this stuff. This is very, very intricate, man, and it has to be perfectly done in order for Cobb to get away. But that's what the Joker goes through in The Dark Knight as well. You know, it's the same thing. Do you guys have any issues with as far as how perfectly these things have to be executed in order for it to work, or does it work for the movie?
Yeah. There's a lot of movies like this where, you know, you start backtracking and it's like, oh, that plan was incredibly convenient. Can't believe that all those steps actually occurred, right? But a lot of the time, the storyteller will say, well, that's what happened. Like, you have to believe that happened in order to go with the story. Yes, it was convenient that happened, but if it happened in real life, then it would have just happened that way. Like, it might be coincidence, mm-hmm. but sometimes things just happen. It all goes back to tone with me. I've said it a dozen times on these podcasts, but if you get the tone of a film correct, whether it's a comedy or a horror movie or whatever, it sort of cures a lot of problems for you. I feel like this movie has a pretty decent, pretty consistent tone. So a lot of those small things, I'm a little more forgiving than I think I might be if, say, the music wasn't doing a lot of the heavy lifting, a lot of the dramatic heavy lifting, right? Mm. Again, make of that what you will. So
I'm willing to go with it just because I think the nonlinear structure allows you to get away with some, I don't want to call them plot holes, but you don't have to be as finite with the details of the plot if you're jumping around so much and playing with perception. So for all you know, things could have happened in between to justify everything being in motion so perfectly. So I think that's one way that the way Nolan plays with the structure can overcome those quote-unquote plot holes.
So Cobb tells Bill that if he has issue with who they nabbed, then he can be the one who chooses the next place they break into. We see Bill, complete with short hair, walk into a bar and start a conversation with who we only know as the blonde. That's how she's labeled in the credits. And she informs him that he can't sleep with her because she's here with the club owner, or as Bill calls him, the bored old cunt. He introduces himself not as Bill, but as Danny Lloyd. And combined with the Shining posters, Matt, that you mentioned earlier in Bill's apartment, I'd say Nolan has quite an affinity to The Shining and Kubrick, wouldn't you?
For sure.
The blonde tells him to see her outside in 10 minutes and walks out. We then see her in his apartment as she swipes a broken artist doll, which is the perfect metaphor for what she's going to do to this poor artist's life. She makes conversation about how she was burgled and how bad the ball guy in the bar is. We then cut to Bill, complete with a shiner, making a phone call to somebody who sounds like Cobb. And at this point, I think it is the man who owns the club that beat him up and gave him the black eye. You don't think that it's Cobb who does this to him, you know? It's kind of weird how Nolan has structured this, where we are just now seeing this ball guy for the first time. And right after that, we see Bill with the black eye. So automatically, I'm putting the association, oh, the ball guy must have been the one who gives it to him.
Yeah. You know,
we see Bill and Cobb. They're walking upstairs, and they go to the place that Bill suggested. But once they get inside, we see that it is indeed Bill's place. This was a funny reveal, and Cobb even seems to be kind of playing along with it being a banker. and then taking tapes while rummaging through a UB-40, which I didn't think was anything other than a band that Danny Elfman was in, UB-40.
Right.
I didn't know that was the unemployment forms of the British. And as they leave, we see a Batman symbol on the door. That took me by surprise.
Yeah, pretty funny.
That was very cool to see. I didn't know. I thought Nolan wasn't a fan of Batman, but it kind of shows when he comes out this door. This is what he's a fan of Batman at this point. Bill then shows up at the blonde's place where she says that the people who burgled her place took books, some CDs, as well as some underwear, an earring, and a bag. He approaches her as she's getting dressed, and they share a kiss, during which she looks uninterested at the camera. And Jack, this is a very noir thing to do, isn't it?
Oh, I mean,
this whole look at the camera and fade out.
It just reeked of Hitchcock. Like, it just felt like a moment in Rear Window or like To Catch a Thief or something. And it was, you know, it was funny to hear him in that Vice interview. He kind of indirectly calls that out. You know, he's like, I don't know if this noir aspect is, everybody's going to be interested in it, but I'm interested in it, kind of thing. So very cool. But yeah, I mean, it's right there. I mean, it's impossible to not make that connection.
But it's also established in the opening with the MacGuffin of that box that you see the hands constructing. Yeah. It looks like a killer putting together their toolbox to murder inconspicuously. So I think the Hitchcock touches are right away pretty prevalent. And yeah, noir, absolutely. You guys are both right.
I took this as one of two things. Either she was completely uninterested, or Cobb was looking at them through a window or something. Just that look, just it reeked of just uninterested. I love the way Nolan frames that. We then see Bill loading up with some gloves and a hammer. Interesting thing about this hammer, which I learned during the commentary, is it was originally scripted to be a gun. But Nolan never liked how guns in independent films looked, so we just had a friend just kind of make this hammer up out of rubber. I couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah.
We then cut to the same window of the blonde's apartment getting taken out, and it is here where we see the burglary that she had described to Bill. So at this point, we really have no idea that the blonde and Cobb even know each other. We think it's separate. Are you guys with the noir aspects of this story? Are you guys still involved in it? Is it so cold that you guys are uninterested in the characters? How are we feeling at this point, boys? We're a little more than halfway in, I think.
Yeah, still with it. There's nothing that's, you know, been outright offensive to me or made me become uninterested. I don't know that the game is... I don't know that the movie is doing any more now than it did 30 minutes prior to keep me interested. But, you know, I'm still with it.
I'm more with it for the technical aspects than I am the actual characters or performances, for that matter, because to be honest, I think Nolan, one thing he struggles with, I think this is more prevalent in some of his other films, is that the female character is entirely disposable and or is the weakest component of his movie, because it's even literal. She is not named and she doesn't really have any desires of her own because she's being manipulated by Cobb, as we find out. And I think that's something Nolan really struggles with through a lot of his movies, with I'd say one exception, maybe two.
Cobb and Bill, they didn't head up to another building, and something happens here that's small, yet gives a great foreshadowing of what's to come. Because Cobb hands him what I'm guessing is a soda, but he shakes it up before doing so, and then when Bill opens it, it just spritz all over him. It's subtle, but a real dickhead thing to do, and an obvious indication that he doesn't really treasure Bill's company like Bill treasures his. This was a fucking dickhead thing to do.
Yeah, a little bit.
But it's something I could definitely envision Jack you doing to me at like Lollapalooza.
Oh, or
I could see you doing.
Come on, give me more credit than that. Jeez.
It's also here where Cobb just tells them to hold on to the stuff that they took until they need it. And after agreeing to go to dinner, we then cut to not Bill and Cobb, but Bill and the blonde having coffee and talking about how dangerous the bald guy is, describing a time he killed somebody in her flat on her carpet. It took me a couple of viewings to catch this, boys, but it is in this dinner conversation where we see Bill use the credit card that Cobb gave to him. Bill then makes his way to a safe and opens it. And, you know, it hit me while watching this, too, that the name Cobb and safes, which are both going to, these things are both going to play a huge part in the movie we're going to be covering down the line. And that can be traced to this one. I didn't know that he had safes and Cobb and following like Inception later on. You know, it's kind of funny to put those things together. So he takes the money out and realizes he doesn't have a bag to haul it out, but there's some tape. And after seeing him shake to soda, I can't help but wonder if this was Cobb once again fucking with him. You have all this money and you have this envelope you got to take out. So just use this tape and you'll get out just fine. We then see a conversation with Bill and Cobb. Dinner where Cobb first gives Bill the Deloitte credit card and has him sign it, with Cobb telling Bill that he isn't going to get caught because he's thought it all the way through. So Bill has put all his trust in this Cobb gentleman, and that's going to definitely come back to bite him. But the woman whose flat they first broke into... She walks into the restaurant, and with how paranoid Bill is, Cobb says that if he's so worried about getting caught, he should cut his hair and change his clothes. We then see Bill cut his hair and then go through the bag they got from the blonde's house with candlesticks, books, CDs, a clock, pictures, and of course the box. You know, I love how this is coming around, guys, because we see this box being put together in the beginning, and I can't help but wonder if Cobb put it together knowing that what he would put in here would cause him to fall in love with the blonde. You know, it's kind of funny that that he tells him you can find a lot about somebody with their box, and he puts the seahorse in. Jack, what do you make of this quote-unquote box that everybody seems to have?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that it shows up at the beginning of the movie and it's a mystery box, I'm immediately like, oh, J.J. Abrams' mystery box. Here we go. And, you know, it creates intrigue. It's somewhat interesting at first, ultimately meaningless. It's your classic MacGuffin, right? But, you know, it's pushing us through the story here. I mean, this is while the time jumps make this story a lot more complicated than it actually is, the story is just very simple. Yeah. When you break it down. And the whole thing with the box, it gets us further along, further down the road of the narrative. It's not bothering me, but it's just tough. I don't know. Again, there are certain earmarks to this film of student filmmaker, even though he's not he never went to film school, but it still feels like that. You know, it's just, you know, somebody explaining their actions instead of just acting. You know, when they're the first burglary that they go on, when Cobb's explaining what he does, he's like, you know, you take something away and you make them think about whether or not they actually want it or whatever the line was. And it's like, that's, you can't just show us that. Like, a better filmmaker finds a way to visually do that, you know. But if you're making one of your first film, you haven't necessarily developed the chops to know how to convey that idea. I understand, you know. So it's, I don't know. There's a lot going on here. You asked about the box. The box is fine, you know, but it is what it is.
Now, Matt, as somebody who hates J.J. Abrams' mystery boxes, how are you feeling at this point?
Well, the difference between Abrams and Nolan is that Abrams, a lot of times when he does his mystery box, that is entirely what he structures his movie around. Nolan doesn't do that here. The box here is strictly it's like what Jack said, it's a MacGuffin. It's not this all-powerful, all-encompassing object that they're after. Like, this very well could have been the crux of the movie. You could have made this a heist where he manipulates him to go get the box for 70 minutes or whatever it is, but I don't mind it. It's not really frustrating me. What I am frustrated by is I understand these are student actor, you know, inexperienced actors, but I think the main guy is just very, when things escalate, he doesn't do a good job of getting me in his headspace, or I don't feel the paranoia alongside him or anything like that. It's just, I'm always at an arm's length away.
Bill then calls Cobb and tells him that he's going to go ahead and try a burglary on his own. But after he hangs up, we see that Cobb is actually with the blonde, and they would seem to be in cahoots. We then cut to Bill wrapped up in tape, and man, does he look ridiculous in this tape. But he's attacked by who I actually thought was Cobb at first. We see somebody coming at him in this place, but it's not. It's one of the bald man's henchmen. Bill takes care of him using the hammer and then gets out of there with an envelope in hand. We then cut to Bill showing up at the blonde's place, trying to apologize for not being totally honest, as his research about burglaries led to her break-in, which is why he asked her so many questions about it. And she reveals that the bald guy is blackmailing her for photos of her, and he has to get into the bar's safe to get them. Bill assures her that he won't get caught, and I'd assume that this is where he sleeps with her. This is where the sleeping happens, where the sex between the two of them happens. We then cut to Bill walking on the roof and running into Cobb, who opens the bag, and it is here where Bill reveals his plan to retrieve the photos. So why the hell does Cobb beat the hell out of him? Is it just jealousy?
Seems that way. I didn't really think about this. I don't know. I'm not sure. Matt, maybe you have a good, better explanation than that, but
I was hoping one of you did, because I had this question written down.
What I took it as, and this could be me just completely pulling things from the air, but right here, I feel like Cobb is kind of taking the training wheels off, so to speak. He has to break away from this so that Cobb can actually get away, and this is his way of doing it, by just beating the hell out of him and not making him want to reacquaint with him and get more help. That was what I took it as, but
that's true. I guess at some point he has to push him towards, needs to turn him into an adversary so that he eventually turns himself into the police.
Yeah.
I guess that kind of tracks.
We then see Cobb and the blonde. They're having a conversation where he questions why she slept with him. And revealing a little anecdote here is when he says that she should have slept with him if she had to, but it's not the same thing as telling her to. So that does point to it being a little bit about jealousy. It's also here where we hear the tale of Cobb seeing the beating and murder of an old woman, and he needs to find someone of roughly the same appearance to lay the blame on. This is a little late to introduce the story into this story, isn't it? Why didn't we hear about this earlier? Or as you said, Jack, why not show this earlier before we get to Bill and his reasons for following people?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that either. Sorry, yeah. I just don't. I don't really understand. I don't have a good answer.
We see curiosity gets the best of Bill, and he opens the envelope that he stole, only to reveal that there are just old modeling photos of the blonde, once again proving that he's been duped. Matt, is this where you're saying that this actor is not really holding his weight? You don't like when he's just pushed against the wall and has to come unhinged against this girl?
Yeah, his big blow up at the end is kind of, I don't want to call it amateurish because there are circumstances that were out of their way. But it's also one of those things to where the movie, because it's nonlinear, and if you're paying attention, you can put the pieces together. This is not a reveal for the audience. So right away, you have to be fully invested in the character feeling like he's been swindled. And because I don't feel that, it suffers for me.
So he does show up at the blonde's house, and is here where she reveals that Bill was nothing but a decoy, displaying the same methods needed for Cobb to get away, and it was actually Cobb who followed Bill and chose him to be the decoy. Bill feels desperate, and he goes to the police, and is revealed here that it's been the police he's been talking to this entire time, instead of a shrink, which I thought of at the beginning. And we learn in this final breakdown that the murder of the old lady was a lie, and that the blonde was murdered using the same hammer and MO that was used before. Her fingers were smashed to, as the cops assume, get the safe combination, and they also find her underwear, pearl earring, and the credit card that Bill had used before. We then cut to Cobb out free and in the crowd as credits roll after 70 minutes of following. Any word on this wrap-up, boys, before we close things out?
I really like the last shot. I think it's pretty cool. It's stylish. I don't know. There was something about it that it felt... Again, there are little things throughout this movie that feel like a sort of a fully formed artist, I guess, in some ways. Mm-hmm. I just really like the shot. I think it's even more impressive that, you know, the way that he had to shoot the movie, the way he had to get a shot like that. Yeah, I think it ends on a relative high note stylistically. Character-wise, yeah. But it's all about, like, for me, the sort of puzzle box of putting the thing together. I think it comes together at the end well.
Agreed. I like how the guy who's being followed assimilates back into the crowd so you can't find him. Like I said, Nolan's not a very subtle filmmaker, but I don't feel like I'm being browbeaten with that hammer that guy was killed with. So that's a win for him.
All right. So that does it for following. On a scale of 1 to 10, what do we give this 70-minute, I guess we could call a student film, from Mr. Chris Nolan? Matt, you go ahead and go, sir.
The comparison I used for Killer's Kiss, I think that's the amicable comparison. I would also compare it to, it's a lesser version of Blood Simple, as far as, you know, a neo-noir kind of approach, in that Nolan is establishing himself as a filmmaker, but unlike the Coen brothers, where I think they really finitely put their stamp on who they were going to be, Nolan's still kind of trying to figure out who he is in some capacity, but a lot of that's more technical than it is his directing choices in his script writing. But for what it is, it's a great technical exercise, and I don't say that in an insulting way, because I like how Nolan is, he's playing with tropes. He's playing with sort of the noir aesthetic of the blonde who is in league with the gangster that has to be rescued initially. And I think he does a good job with the resources he has. It's just that ultimately it's a movie that it's very clinical, and I'm not fully on board with the protagonist's journey because I think he's kind of aloof and unlikable. You know, I'm speaking on personal bias here. It's just not something that I gravitate towards too, especially with my noir films. There's a great movie I'm going to plug if anyone's looking for potential movie homework, Jack. There's a great little movie called Detour that came out in, it was the mid-40s. And it's also like 70 minutes. And it's about a hitchhiker who gets picked up, and then he sort also gets tangled in this sort of squeeze by a woman that has repercussions. That's a great movie, because I think that guy's great and he does a good job of getting you in his head and being over his head. Mm-hmm. So all in all, I think it's a fine movie. It's a good first impression. But to be honest, I really don't have any urge to revisit it on a regular basis. So I'm going to go in the grand scheme of Nolan's filmography, this is a 6/10 for me.
6/10 from Mr. Goudreau. Jack, sir, what do you fall on following?
A lot of what Matt said I agree with. I think that, it's kind of rare to find a filmmaker whose first film I like
to revisit. It's just tough. You see the beginnings of things that they go to do later better or in bigger ways or in more developed ways, maybe more nuanced ways. And this movie's full of that stuff. That being said, I do think it's one of the better first efforts from a filmmaker that I can remember. All the ones that we just brought up, with maybe the exception of Blood Simple, Party, El Mariachi, they're films that I've seen. I don't know if I'll watch them again. I probably will watch them again, but it will be out of just like morbid curiosity 20 years after the fact. It's not like I revisit them the way that I revisit some of these filmmakers' other films. Again, Blood Simple is an exception. I think that one's actually pretty fucking awesome. I think the performances are fine. They get you through the movie. They're nothing great. I think the direction is what's on showcase here, and I really like a lot of what Nolan does. The fact that he starts with the nonlinear stuff with this film, the fact that despite not, you know, having Hans Zimmer in his wheelhouse, he still gets a composer who's able to produce a score that provides momentum and stress and drama, and it really helps the movie move. And while obviously he goes on to make much more complicated camera movements and shots in other films, there are little things that he does here that I like quite a bit, especially that final shot. Some of the shots of Bill moving through the crowd I think are pretty interesting. Again, given the fact that they couldn't legally get those shots without sneaking them. But at the end of the day, I probably won't watch this again for another decade. So I'm at a 6 on 10 as well. I think it's good. I think it's one of the better first efforts. I think it's worth seeing. I don't know if it's worth rewatching again, though.
Yeah, I'm pretty much on par with both you gentlemen. I'm going to pay a huge compliment here. You know, I think a biggest compliment you can give somebody, especially with their first film, is you don't think about the budget. And with the exception of some of the sound mix being really bad, I didn't think at all while watching this about the $5,000 budget that went into this. I was actually right with the story. But Matt, I agree with you where the protagonist, and we're going to see this quite a bit in this retrospective, I can't find myself really rooting for the protagonist in this. I don't fall for his plight here. With the exception of the beginning, I was thinking, wow, are these all figments of his imagination? Once that went away, I was like, wow, what about this guy? Am I rooting for him to get through this? And why is he's still with this? At the same time, you see a lot of what Nolan does later on in this movie. I mean, he uses a lot of the same things that he does in his entire career in this movie. And Jack, I agree with you where it's not the polished nuance that we'd see later on from him, but the time jump narratives, using music to move the operatic type storytelling along, that stuff, he starts right here. I think it's a good first effort, but like you gentlemen, I'm not going to revisit it. I also have written down here 6 out of 10 as well. I do think it is worth visiting, though. I do think it is worth seeing at least once, especially since we're getting close to a release of a new film of his. If you haven't seen Following yet, check it out. It is not, like I said earlier, it's not a polished watch. You have to, like all his films, you have to sit and pay close attention to it. Maybe see it even twice. And in fact, Nolan recommends that you see it twice because that's how you get the most out of it. But I'm telling you, I enjoyed revisiting it for this podcast. But I do see a lot of what's lacking that you guys saw as well. So 6 out of 10 for me. That does it for Following. We got the student film out of the way, boys. Next week, we go to Memento, which, Jack, would you agree with me, is a bigger budgeted remake of this in a lot of ways?
I wouldn't call it a remake. He's definitely developing the skills that he's using, though, in this film. I could definitely, I saw that more rewatching this time than I had previously. They're much closer than I previously thought, but I wouldn't call it a remake.
So Memento was one I saw in theaters. Like I pointed out earlier, I was really praising it when I came out of there. I was so excited about it. I'm looking forward to hearing your guys' takes on it. And next week should be another interesting discussion, because Memento is just one of those movies that if you see the beginnings of a good filmmaker at work here, you see the minting of a filmmaker next week. Matt, what are your memories of Memento before we get to next week?
Memories of Memento. I like that touch, especially considering the movie's like about an amnesiac.
Oh, yeah. Shit. With the puns over here.
I'll give you points for that, coincidental or not. This was a movie that I saw not because of Nolan, but because I'm a huge Guy Pearce fan. And it's always bothered me that he doesn't have a bigger career than he does now. So he was kind of my in. But I would have been, as far as where it fell for me in his order of watching his movies, it would have been Batman Begins I saw first, then I saw Dark Knight, and then after that I think I saw this.
Jack, what were your memories of Memento?
Buying the DVD, seeing that the DVD, or hearing that the 2-disc DVD that it came in had a secret version of the movie that if you knew how to find it, played the movie in chronological order. I never actually found that on the disc, though, so I don't know if that was an urban legend or something that was, like, on a different edition or whatever. But yeah, I remember watching this for the first time right around the same time I watched Fight Club. These two movies, like, kind of live in the same space for me. So, yeah, a lot to talk about on the next show, for sure.
For sure. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me with this review of Following. And until next week, we all need podcasts to remind ourselves of who we are. Thanks, guys.
Where's the box?
What box?
Everyone has a box. With men, it's usually a shoebox.
Is there valuables in it?
Nah, more interesting, more personal. Things like snapshots, letters, little trinkets for Christmas. Crack.
The Binge Aftertaste is produced by Garrett and Matt.
So you lie to yourself to be happy. There's nothing wrong with that. We all do it. Who cares if there's a few little details you'd rather not remember?
Voice narration done by Adam.
Randy, did you love her?
Sure, she was nice.
She was nice. Wow. Well, that makes me all soft inside. Where are you?
Out of that tank.
All I wanted to do was prove that I was a better magician.
Did you get mauled by a tiger?
It was a dog.
Huh?
It was a big dog.
You mustn't be afraid to dream a little bigger, darling.
If I pull that off, will you die?
It would be extremely painful.
You're a big guy.
For you.
The station isn't named after you, sir. It's named after your daughter.
Tide's turning now. How can you tell?
The body's come back.
We all believe we've run into the burning building.
Because we have to chase him.
Okay, we're going in! Go, go! Move!
He didn't do anything wrong.
Because he's the hero Gotham deserves. But not the one it needs right now. So we'll hunt him. Because he can take it. Because he's not our hero. He's a silent guardian. A watchful protector. A dark knight.
Bill, especially with his look, with this look, the coat, the longest hair, almost gives like almost like a James McAvoy vibe to me. How do you guys feel about the acting in this film?
You guys have to stop stealing my fucking comparisons. I have to cross McAvoy off my notes now.
Nice.
You've been listening to the Binge Media Podcast Network at BingeMedia.net. Support the show by donating on Patreon at patreon.com/BingeMedia. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Buy some merch at BingeMedia.net/shop. Subscribe to our newsletter at BingeMedia.net/newsletter. And don't forget...
I didn't stop giving handjobs because I wasn't good at it. I stopped giving handjobs because I was the best at it.